Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We're up to chapter 14 and things are getting interesting here at the Rostov's name day party. So let's dive into this nice and quick. As usual, I'll start the podcast by reading the chapter that we're up to. Then that will be followed by a discussion where we unpack that chapter. If you want to skip the reading part of the podcast, look for the timestamp in the description. Alright, here we go. This is Book 1, Chapter 14 of Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. After receiving her visitors, the Countess was so tired that she gave orders to admit no more. But the porter was told to be sure to invite to dinner all who came to congratulate. The footnotes here say that it is a Russian custom formally to congratulate people not only on births, engagements, marriages, and other auspicious occasions, but also on holidays, saints' days, or name days, birthdays, and so on. The Countess wished to have a tete-a-tete talk with the friend of her childhood, Prince Anna Mikhailovna, whom she had not seen properly since she returned from Petersburg. Anna Mikhailovna, with her tear-worn but pleasant face, drew her chair nearer to that of the Countess. "With you, I will be quite frank," said Anna Mikhailovna. "There are not many left of us old friends. That's why I so value your friendship." Anna Mikhailovna looked at Vera and paused. The Countess pressed her friend's hand. "Vera," she said to her eldest daughter, who was evidently not a favourite, "how is it you have so little tact? Don't you see you are not wanted here? Go to the other girls, or..." The handsome Vera smiled contemptuously, but did not seem at all hurt. "If you had told me sooner, Mama, I should have gone," she replied as she rose to go to her own room. But as she passed the sitting room, she noticed two couples sitting, one pair at each window. She stopped and smiled scornfully. Sonya was sitting close to Nicholas, who was copying out some verses for her, the first he had ever written. Boris and Natasha were at the other window and ceased talking when Vera entered. Sonya and Natasha looked at Vera with guilty, happy faces. It was pleasant and touching to see these little girls in love, but apparently the sight of them roused no pleasant feeling in Vera. "How often have I asked you not to take my things?" she said. "You have a room of your own." And she took the inkstand from Nicholas. In a minute, he said, dipping his pen. "You always manage to do things at the wrong time," continued Vera. "You came rushing into the drawing room so that everyone felt ashamed of you." Though what she said was quite just, perhaps for that very reason no one replied, and the four simply looked at one another. She lingered in the room with the inkstand in her hand. "At your age, what secrets can there be between Natasha and Boris, or between you two? It's all nonsense." "Now, Vera, what does it matter to you?" said Natasha in defence, speaking very gently. She seemed that day to be more than ever kind and affectionate to everyone. "Very silly," said Vera. "I am ashamed of you. Secrets, indeed." "All have secrets of their own," answered Natasha, getting warmer. "We don't interfere with you and Berg." "I should think not," said Vera, "because there can never be anything wrong in my behaviour. But I'll just tell Mama how you are behaving with Boris." "Natalia Ilyinichna behaves very well to me," remarked Boris. "I have nothing to complain of." "Don't, Boris. You are such a diplomat that it is really tiresome," said Natasha, in a mortified voice that trembled slightly. She used the word diplomat, which was just then much in vogue among the children, in the special sense they attached to it. "Why does she bother me?" And she added, turning to Vera, "You'll never understand it, because you've never loved anyone. You have no heart. You are a Madame de Genlis, and nothing more." This nickname, bestowed on Vera by Nicholas, was considered very stinging. "And your greatest pleasure is to be unpleasant to people. Go and flirt with Berg as much as you please," she finished quickly. "I shall at any rate not run after a young man before visitors." "Well, now you've done what you wanted," put in Nicholas, "said unpleasant things to everyone and upset them. Let's go to the nursery." All four, like a flock of scared birds, got up and left the room. "The unpleasant things were said to me," remarked Vera. "I said none to anyone." "Madame de Genlis, Madame de Genlis," shouted laughing voices through the door. The handsome Vera, who produced such an irritating and unpleasant effect on everyone, smiled and, evidently unmoved by what had been said to her, went to the looking glass and arranged her hair and scarf. Looking at her own handsome face, she seemed to become still colder and calmer. In the drawing room, the conversation was still going. "Ah, my dear," said the Countess, "my life is not all roses either. Don't I know that at the rate we are living, our means won't last long? It's all the club and his easy-going nature. Even in the country, do we get any rest? Theatricals, hunting, and heaven knows what besides. But don't let's talk about me. Tell me how you managed everything. I often wonder at you, Annette. How at your age you can rush off alone in a carriage to Moscow, to Petersburg, to those ministers and great people, and know how to deal with them all. It's quite astonishing. How did you get things settled? I couldn't possibly do it." "Ah, my love," answered Anna Mikhailovna, "God grant you never know what it is to be left a widow without means and with a son you love to distraction. One learns many things then," she added with a certain pride. "That lawsuit taught me much. When I want to see one of those big people, I write a note. Princess so-and-so desires an interview with so-and-so. And then I take a cab and I go myself 2, 3, or 4 times till I get what I want. I don't mind what they may think of me." "Well, and to whom did you apply about Bori?" asked the Countess. "You see, yours is already an officer in the Guards, while my Nicholas is going as a cadet. There's no one to interest himself for him. To whom did you apply?" The footnotes here say that a cadet was a volunteer, usually of good family, who had not yet received a commission, but whose place in the army was with the officers and not in the ranks. "To Prince Vasily. He was so kind. He at once agreed to everything and put the matter before the Emperor," said Princess Anna Mikhailovna enthusiastically, quite forgetting all the humiliation she had endured to gain her end. "Has Prince Vasily aged much?" asked the Countess. "I have not seen him since we acted together at the Rumyantsov's theatricals. I expect he has forgotten me. He paid me attentions in those days," said the Countess with a smile. "He is just the same as ever," replied Anna Mikhailovna, overflowing with amiability. "His position has not turned his head at all. He said to me, 'I am sorry I can do so little for you, dear princess. I am at your command.' Yes, he is a fine fellow and a very kind relation. But, Natalie, you know my love for my son. I would do anything for his happiness. And my affairs are in such a bad way that my position is now a terrible one," continued Anna Mikhailovna, sadly dropping her voice. "My wretched lawsuit takes all I have and makes no progress. Would you believe it? I have literally not a penny and don't know how to equip Boris." She took out her handkerchief and began to cry. "I need 500 rubles and have only 1 25-ruble note. I am in such a state. My only hope now is in Count Cyril Vladimirovich Bezukhov. If he will not assist his godson, you know he is Boris' godfather, and allow him something for his maintenance, all my trouble will have been thrown away. I shall not be able to equip him." The Countess's eyes filled with tears and she pondered in silence. "I often think, though perhaps it's a sin," said the Princess, "that here lives Count Cyril Vladimirovich Bezukhov, so rich, all alone, that tremendous fortune, and what is his life worth? It's a burden to him, and Boris's life is only just beginning." "Surely he will leave something to Boris," said the Countess. "Heaven only knows, my dear. These rich grandees are so selfish. Still, I will take Boris and go to see him at once, and I shall speak to him straight out. Let people think what they will of me. It's really all the same to me when my son's fate is at stake." The Princess rose. "It's now 2 o'clock, and you dine at 4. There will just be time." And like a practical Petersburg lady who knows how to make the most of time, Anna Mikhailovna sent someone to call her son and went into the anteroom with him. "Goodbye, my dear," said she to the Countess, who saw her to the door, and added in a whisper so that her son should not hear, "Wish me good luck." "Are you going to Count Cyril Vladimirovich, my dear?" said the Count, coming out from the dining hall into the anteroom, and he added, "If he is better, ask Pierre to dine with us. He has been to the house, you know, and danced with the children. Be sure to invite him, my dear. We will see how Taras distinguishes himself today. He says Count Orlov never gave such a dinner as ours will be. All right, there we have it. A little bit of a longer chapter with a fair bit of stuff to unpack there. So we start with Vera, the oldest of the Rostov children, essentially being kicked out of the room by her mother and their guest, Anna Mikhailovna, so that they can discuss some private matters. They kick her out rather rudely, but she doesn't seem too fussed at all. There's a real stoic nature to this Vera character. Everyone seems rather mean to her, and she just takes it in her stride. So really, this chapter is split into two halves. There's what happens in the drawing room between Anna Mikhailovna and the Countess, and then there's what happens between the children in the sitting room outside. So Vera confronts her siblings and basically tells them that their behaviour was terrible and that they should be ashamed of themselves. And I really like that Natasha, the 13-year-old, the youngest person in the scene, is the one who stands up for them, and she does it really quite well. She's not overly defensive, but she bites back in equal measures, and then when that doesn't work, she resorts to a bit of name-calling and sort of mocks her older sister until she goes away. All in all, a pretty effective way to get an annoying older sibling to leave you alone. Then the four of them, Nicholas and Sonia and Natasha and Boris, they kind of run away laughing and name-calling Vera, saying, Madame de Genlis, Madame de Genlis. But Vera really doesn't seem too bothered by this at all. It seems like everything that's thrown at her is water off a duck's back. In response to them mocking her and teasing her, she smiles and then looks in the mirror. Really not much of a likable character, this Vera. Very cold. Now that name, Madame de Genlis, that they mock Vera with, that was obviously a reference that went over my head. I had no idea what that meant. But luckily there was some discussion around it on the subreddit page, A Year of War and Peace, and they did their thing and got to the bottom of it. Reddit user Leith Seal said, I looked up Madame de Genlis, the name teasingly given to Vera by Sonia, Natasha and the boys, and it appears that she was a rather prolific writer, famed for her quick wit and propensity for quarrelling. Perhaps there's another reason, but that's the only parallel I could see on Wikipedia, and I'm probably missing something much more obvious. Another Reddit user, Lowdown, responded, Madame de Genlis was also thought to be a spy working for Napoleon. Maybe the other children think of her only as someone gathering information to hurt them later. My take on this was that perhaps, for the younger kids especially, anti-Napoleon sentiment was popular. These are kids whose parents are from very high society Russia, who would be very anti-Napoleon. And I think these kids are just in that young enough bracket that the parents can essentially tell them what their political standpoint should be, and they essentially take their parents' political view and run with it. Therefore, an insult along the lines of, you're a spy for Napoleon, would be particularly apt for them. My understanding of these political issues where there are opposing political ideologies is that in the developmental years of children, it's quite easy to sway them to think one way or another, as their parents do. It's in the sort of older age bracket, around where Pierre is, that it's a bit harder to indoctrinate them with your own opinion. For a kid of 13, their political viewpoint would be very much structured around whatever their parents dictate to them it should be. And for someone a little older, like Pierre, and especially someone who's been out and seen the world, and maybe spent those formative years in another place where there's a different prevailing ideology, you can see why there might be some sort of dissidence between Pierre and the social norm. Regardless, no one seems overly hurt by this exchange. Vera's not too bothered, the kids aren't too bothered, and that makes me think that this is not an uncommon occurrence between these siblings. They clearly don't get along very well. Another line that sort of went over my head but seemed like it was a bit meaningful was the following one. Don't, Boris, you're such a diplomat. That is really tiresome, said Natasha in a mortified voice that trembled slightly. She used the word diplomat, which was just then much in vogue among the children, in the special sense they attached to it. When I read that, I wasn't quite sure what that special sense was that is referred to regarding the word diplomat, so I asked the question on Reddit. Brian E. Denton was kind enough to respond, and he said, That's a good question. I've actually wondered about the special meaning of diplomat myself here. Though I haven't had my thoughts confirmed by any Tolstoy scholars, I've always read it as a new adult word the Rostov children use to denote someone who talks too much. Let me know what you think, or if you find it covered anywhere else. Again, my feelings here is it might be just anti-Napoleon sentiment. Napoleon was seen as a diplomat. And the one thing that did strike me here is that it does seem like Natasha's insults are all kind of politically flavoured. So without knowing too much about Natasha, and really I don't know her political standpoint yet, I'm just speculating, I'd be interested to see if that's the case, or if that seems to fit with her character as she develops later on. Reddit user PKIGuy22 said, I wondered if Vera was smiling into the mirror, as if practicing her facial expressions when being mocked, like she's just trying to get better at masking her emotions. Yeah, I feel like that could be the case. It does seem to suit her character, someone who would take pride in how emotionless her face can remain while receiving insults. You get the feeling with Vera that she's copped so much flack over the years that she's actually quite good at handling it. So back in the drawing room, Anna Mikhailovna is talking to the Countess about how she was able to curry favour with Prince Vasily in order to get her son Boris into the Guards. She then sort of turns on the waterworks and starts talking about her financial problems and how exhausting it is travelling here and there to ask favours of people. I had an interpretation of this part of the chapter that I didn't see reflected in the discussion. It seemed to me that in bringing up her financial struggles and talking about how she needed to visit Count Bezukhov to ask him for money, what she was actually doing is roundabout bringing up her financial problems in the hopes that the Countess might step in and offer some money. The scene plays out really quickly after she brings up her money problems. She brings it up, the Countess doesn't offer money, and within a few sentences she's getting up to leave. It seemed very much that she was playing an angle here, and that maybe the whole point of her visit was to see if she could get the Countess to bankroll Boris's entry into the Guards. On the subreddit, there was a discussion prompt by Reddit user Turtle Vader, who asked, in an earlier chapter, Prince Vasily has the thought that influence in society is a capital that must be used sparingly, lest it disappear. Anna seems to be using her influence a great deal, trying to give her son the start of a successful military career. Do you think her influence will disappear? Will she be able to properly send off her son Boris before it does? In response to this, Reddit user Garrock said, I think Anna has used up whatever political capital she had remaining. She has no favours to call upon anymore, and her appeal to historical alliances seems to have now been exhausted. I imagine her now as the type of person who enters the party and everyone rolls their eyes, trying to avoid being drawn into a conversation with her. She'll either ask you for something or talk about glories from the past. So yeah, in this case, I think Vasily was spot on. I certainly would agree with that. I think if Anna Mikhailovna continues on like she is, going around asking favours of people, she's very soon going to gain a reputation as someone who's not very pleasant to have around at these parties and social functions. I quite like the character of Count Rostov in these chapters, and I liked how at the very end of this chapter, just as Anna Mikhailovna is leaving, the Count says to her, if you see Pierre, please invite him to our house for dinner. It seems that Count Rostov likes Pierre. He was very amused by Pierre's antics with the bear and the policeman. And he's also aware that Pierre is Count Bezukhov's favourite son of all his sons, even though he is an illegitimate son. So I really hope that Pierre does accept this invitation to dinner and we get a scene which includes Pierre and Count Rostov. Alright, I think on that note we'll end it there. Thank you very much for listening and I will see you tomorrow.